This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with the legendary journalist, Carl Bernstein. He's in Baton Rouge and at LSU today as part of the centennial for the Manship School, a sold-out address at the LSU Union coming later today. And he will be with us to talk about the state of American journalism and what he's up to since Watergate, which, by the way, was now 41 years ago. Carl Bernstein remains one of the vital voices on the American scene, and we will converse with him about the goings-on on Capitol Hill. I'm sure he has some thoughts about the events of the last few weeks and what to expect in the years to come. Last time we talked with him, he had just written a biography about Hillary Clinton. Will she be running in 2016? We'll talk to Carl about this and much more. But now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your local number. If you're dialing outside the local area, it is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And in-house, a special treat, the legendary Carl Bernstein, who, along with Bob Woodward, became household names in the 1970s by virtue of their reporting on Watergate for the Washington Post. 41 years have elapsed since the break-in at Watergate on June 17, 1972, but Carl Bernstein has been a busy man all these years since, and today he is speaking at the LSU Union, a sold-out address, by the way, but it's part of the centennial for the Manship School, and all of this has been put together by the dean of the Manship School, Jerry Seppas, who is sitting beside Carl, but Carl has the microphone right now, and good to see you, Mr. Carl Bernstein.
Good to be here. I always like being in this part of the country.
You've been here in, before, I take.
I have. Actually, the last time I was at LSU, my son, Max, who was a rock and roll musician, was playing here.
When was that?
It's about 8 years ago, actually.
Yeah.
He was playing a little club downtown. Yeah, he had his own band then called The Actual. Since then, he's been Kesha's guitar player and gone around the world with Kesha. And now is playing with and directing a boy band called Emblem 3. So,
well, I'm happy he's doing well.
He's having a good time.
He's gone in his own direction. Did he think about how many journalists became journalists because of Woodward and Bernstein? And
well, his brother is a reporter for the New York Times, I'm proud to say, Jacob. So... A father couldn't ask for more. I mean, that's really a dream. One is a journalist, and I used to be a rock critic, and the other is a rock and roll musician. So that's pretty good.
Well, it started for you very young. You were not the best-known reporter in the world when Watergate erupted in all its fury, 28 years old at the time. You grew up in Washington, though. It was a city you knew well.
I'm a native of Washington. And actually, the fact that... that I am a native of Washington, and the fact that Bob Woodward, like me, was a local reporter, not a national reporter, so that we approached the Watergate story very much the way local reporters go after a story, like a police story, rather than approaching it as some matter of high state affairs, was really one of the factors that enabled us to do whatever we were able to. To accomplish.
I mentioned the date of the break-in. At what point did you write your first story?
The break-in was on June 17th, 1972, which seems like ancient history. And the first story appeared in the next day's paper. That was a Saturday, and it appeared in the Sunday paper on the 18th. It had the byline on it was of our police reporter at the Washington Post, and then at the end of the story, it had a bunch of italicized names of others who had worked on the story that day, included Woodward's name and myself.
Did you have any idea about the magnitude of this story at the onset?
Knew that it was a big story. That, you know, five men wearing rubber gloves, dressed in business suits, arrested at the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee, trying to put a bug in or repair a bug, and carrying photographic equipment to reproduce files, etc., you had to know right away that, that something important had happened here. Mm-hmm. Who was responsible? My first guess, and this goes to what reporting journalism is really about, which is to not be bound by your preconceived notion of what a story might be. It's fine to have a hunch and use it as a starting point, but my first thought was that the CIA might have had something to do with it because of the seven burglars, all of them had associations with the CIA, though it didn't make much sense why they would be doing this, but there have been rogue CIA operations before and since, so that was my first guess.
We're visiting with Carl Bernstein, and he was there, along with Bob Woodward, broke the story wide open, the Watergate break-in 41 years ago. We're as close to Watergate now as Watergate was to Herbert Hoover.
That's a very good way of putting it, so let's move on.
But it's something that is part of the lore of journalism, and for good reason. It brought down a president. Why did Nixon and his associates do this? He was on his way to an overwhelming landslide victory in 1972. This was June. Why in the world were they doing this?
Well, because the Watergate break-in was just a small part of, one, a massive campaign of political espionage and sabotage ordered by the President of the United States, criminal presidency, a criminal president who undermined the Constitution of the United States in a way that, that no other president has. Nixon is really sui generis in our history in that way. He's by himself in this regard. At the same time, he's also the most interesting political figure, probably American political figure of the second half of the 20th century. He strides over a 50-year period of our history from the time he's elected. So why would he have done this? Well, it turns out, as we know now, we had an inkling of it from our reporting, but really there were five wars of Watergate conducted by Nixon from the day almost that he arrived in office, and that was using illegal methods, unconstitutional methods, to fight his political opponents in the Democratic Party and those he perceived as his political enemies, which is partly what the break-in itself was about. Against the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement at the time. Again, these same illegal methods, political espionage, sabotage, to break up the anti-war movement, to keep tabs on it, to use illegal means to find out what it was doing. A war against the press, as we saw, you know, the response of the Nixon White House to our stories. And it has gone back to the Pentagon Papers, actually, in which the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers, this great study of what had gone wrong in the war in Vietnam. And the Nixon administration tried to restrain it, its publication, went to the Supreme Court and lost. But there was a war against the press in which our conduct was made the issue in Watergate rather than the president and his men. Then there was the war against the system of justice, not just the cover-up of Watergate, but of all kinds of illegal activities that the President of the United States had ordered. I mean, and now we have the tapes, and the last war of Watergate was against history itself. And so you ask, well, why did Nixon do this? And one of the things he did was he installed this taping system in the White House so that every one of his words practically in the Oval Office, on the telephone was recorded. Well, why did he do that? Because Nixon had intended that he would write the greatest of presidential memoirs, that he would have these tape recordings that would enable him to cherry pick and selectively look at what he had accomplished, and he would burnish his presidency and its reputation by drawing from this unbelievable, complete record of his presidency. Well, of course, what the record turned out to be was of his criminality and really a roadmap of his mind. Mm-hmm. This brilliant analytical mind with such paranoia, with such contempt and disdain and hate for his political opponents. And so we hear on the tapes, for instance, forget about just the breaking at Watergate. We hear the President of the United States. He knows that there is in a think tank in Washington some documents that might reflect badly on Lyndon Johnson's conduct of the war in Vietnam, his predecessor. And Nixon's chief of staff says, if we could get those documents, we could blackmail Lyndon Johnson. He means smear on the tapes. And Nixon says, we've been wanting to get those documents for years. Why can't we get them? Because they're in a safe. Nixon then says, break into the goddamn safe. Firebomb the place. I don't care what you do. Get those documents. And this goes on for 13 days. Every day he gets his staff together and says, did somebody break into that damn place? Did you firebomb the place? Where are those documents? This is Richard Nixon, and that is what Watergate is about.
What made Nixon like this? Was it the Hiss case? Was it the Kennedy laws?
You know, it's very interesting what you say about the Hiss case. Let's tell people what the Hiss case. You talk about ancient history. This goes back, if you did it in years, and Watergate goes back to Hoover, the Hiss case would probably go back to Grover Cleveland. Alger Hiss was a State Department, a very high-ranking State Department official, whom had been accused of being a spy for the Soviet Union. He denied it. It became a great cause that he was innocent. It was a cause taken up by the left, but not just the left, but also much of the Democratic center, which believed Hiss was innocent. And that Nixon, who had been so adamant about Hiss and that he should be prosecuted, and Nixon was regarded as his persecutor. And it turns out, of course, that Nixon was right about Hiss. We now know, only 10 years ago, from the so-called Venona transcripts of codes broken of the Soviet Union, only recently, Hiss was a spy. And you hear on the tapes Nixon saying, those sons of bitches on the left have been after me for years because of the Hiss case, and I'm right on the Hiss case. Well, it turns out he was right on the Hiss case. And I, you know, look, this is if history. We don't know. I can't be in the mind of Nixon. But yes, I think the Hiss case does figure in his sense of being persecuted, of him being singled out by political opponents as being below the belt in his basic conduct of how he approached politics, and I think there is truth to his being below the belt in most of his political conduct over much of it over the years. But and he was paranoid, and you know that farewell that Nixon gave in his on the day he resigned on August 8th, 1974, and he stood in the East Room and he gave this monologue that was kind of from somewhere deep in his psyche, kind of a free association of his life. And he talked about, he said, my mother was a saint. And he just kept going.
I think he said
saint. It was the most uncomfortable just to watch him unwind. And at the same time, so fascinating. But then he said something that explains an awful lot. He said, you know, if you hate your enemies and you give them a sword by your hate, they will destroy you, and or you will be destroyed. And I think that Nixon was besieged in his mind by enemies for all of his political life, real and imagined.
We will return with Carl Bernstein, who's still at it. He started his career at 16 as a copy boy with the Washington Star in the year that John Kennedy edged Richard Nixon for the presidency. 297-5633, your number. We'll return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we will go to the phone lines in just a moment, but you may also email us inkstershow@wrkf.org. Carl Bernstein is the guest. He'll be at LSU throughout the day as part of the centennial for the Manship School. As one journalist pointed out, the Manship School started in 1913, and Richard Nixon started in 1913 on January 9th. He would have been 100 years old. He didn't live that long, but he lasted a long time after Watergate. And Carl Bernstein, when he was all of 28, was covering Watergate with a vengeance. And did you have any pressure about any stories you did?
Almost all of them. We had to be right. And, you know, really what we did in Watergate was the most basic kind of empirical, common sense reporting that I first learned when I went to work at the Washington Star when I was 16 years old. Let's look at what is reporting. Reporting is really the best obtainable version of the truth. It is a simple phrase, and it is a very difficult concept if you're going to do it. It requires persistence. It requires common sense. It requires being a good listener. It requires being respectful of the people you're covering. Remember, the people that we got our information from were not Democrats who hated Nixon. They were people who worked for Richard Nixon. So how did we go about that? Back to common sense. We got hold of a list of the people who worked for Richard Nixon for his reelection committee, and we went to their homes at night. We didn't go to their offices where we knew that they'd be seen talking to us by their bosses. We didn't call them on the telephone at their offices. We knocked on their doors. One of the things that is interesting about the movie of All the President's Men, more than the book, is that you see how light comes from darkness, that all this reporting is being done at night. We're going door to door, most of them being slammed in our faces. And yet, one out of five, one out of ten, somebody lets us in. And by engaging as human beings, not as some sheriff. You know, there's an awful lot of, I've seen it too much myself, too many reporters come in like they got a badge and a gun, saying, you know, why'd you rob the bank? And say, whoa, wait a minute, I wasn't anywhere near the damn bank. See what people have to say. My experience in more than half a century of being a reporter is that people want to tell you the truth. They don't want to lie to you. And if you give them a chance to tell the truth, their truth, might be a little skewed from as you try to go elsewhere to see if what they're telling you really checks out. But generally, I think people want to tell you the truth. Just give them a chance. And that's what happened in Watergate. We found people who, yes, reluctantly, but wanted to tell a little piece maybe of what they knew. We found a bookkeeper who knew that something was wrong at Richard Nixon's election committee and that there were secret funds that nobody quite understood, but they sure seemed to be for something nefarious. And we went from there. She was an honest person, and her boss was an honest person, and she was worried that they would be dragged down into this. There are real lessons in the coverage of Watergate. I think one of the things about All the President's Men, both the book and the movie, are that they're not about Bob and myself as big characters. They're really about the process of reporting, and you see it. It's a methodical, not glamorous, enduring, difficult, tiring business. And it helped a lot that there were two of us. It helped a lot that we were young, 28, 29 years old, single at the time. We had those nights available. We had great editor, Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post, who stuck with us, a great publisher, one of the most courageous publishers in the history of American journalism, Catherine Graham. And we were lucky. There are a lot of lessons in this. You know, Watergate, back to this idea of it not being about a break-in, but about this terrible, massive presidential conspiracy against the Constitution, against Nixon's political enemies. That what we see now is the system worked in Watergate. It worked magnificently. The press did its job. Then the judiciary did its job. A great judge in whose courtroom the Watergate burglars were being tried. This judge had read our stories, and he persevered and got the truth out of these burglars who admitted in his courtroom, oh, yeah, those newspaper stories, yeah, they're true because we're being paid for our silence because it's part of a conspiracy that goes way up. And then you think about the Chief Justice of the United States, appointed by Richard Nixon, who had not been a particularly distinguished judge or chief justice. Nixon thought that this chief justice would save him from giving up his tapes that a special prosecutor was seeking. And the chief justice of the United States instead got the other justices of the Supreme Court together and said, we must have a unanimous decision that the president give up these tapes because no one in this country is against the is above the law, even including the President of the United States. And that decision is also what led to the resignation of Richard Nixon. The Senate Watergate Committee, created to investigate the activities of the President of the United States by a 77-0 vote. Imagine a 77-0 vote in the House, in the Senate today, on almost anything. Wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
The House of Representatives voting its Judiciary Committee to articles of impeachment against the President of the United States with Republican votes. No question. And what happened in the end? How did Nixon finally resign? He was going to be tried in the Senate of the United States. He would have needed one-third plus one member to be acquitted. You need two-thirds to be found guilty in a Senate trial for high crimes and misdemeanors. Nixon thought that he might well prevail in the Senate. Barry Goldwater, the great Republican conservative, the 1964 nominee of the Republican Party, took a group of senators and House leaders down to the White House on August 5th or 6th, 1974, sat down with the President of the United States, and Nixon said, Barry, how many votes do I have in the Senate in a trial, thinking that Goldwater would tell him, you'll be acquitted, Mr. President. Goldwater looked at him and said, right now, Mr. President, maybe four, and you don't have mine. And that's when Nixon decided to resign. So the system worked. It worked mm-hmm. magnificently. And what we see now in our political system, in our really a breakdown of government, one of the three branches of government, the legislative branch, the House of Representatives, the Congress of the United States, is broken, doesn't work, dysfunctional, does not work. This has been going on for 20, 25 years, and now in the last month we've seen the absolute total breakdown.
How did we get to this point?
I think we got to this point that you have to look at it culturally. You can't just blame, these turkeys in Washington. That's too easy. Both parties have a role in this, but what we've seen of late in the governmental shutdown, et cetera, was caused really disproportionately by a rabid Republican minority. But what has gotten us to this place is that ideology has now come to supplant the national interest in Washington, particularly in the Congress, much more than the presidency. Ideology, but you can't separate this ideological, this cultural warfare that's been going on in Washington for 20, 25 years now. You can't separate it from the people of the country either, because fewer and fewer people are interested in, I use this phrase, the best obtainable version of the truth about what good reporting really is. Fewer and fewer people in this country are interested in the best obtainable version of the truth. Rather, like in the Congress of the United States, they're looking for information that will buttress and support their ideology, that will make them believe even more the things they already believe, rather than being open, as the people of the country were during Watergate, to the best obtainable version of the truth. We have a terrible, terrible problem in this country, and we're not getting in the right direction toward it. We're going in the wrong direction, because ideology, cultural warfare, people are very, to a less and less degree, I think, are interested in the truth.
Were you ever fearful of your own safety when you were reporting?
I think mostly we were fearful of making mistakes. You know, Nixon had made the White House had made the issue in Watergate our conduct at the Washington Post, that this was a, you know, this was a struggle mm-hmm. between the President of the United States and a journalistic institution and its reporters and editors. And one side was going to turn out to be right. And we knew we were right, and at the same time, we did not know that we were going to be shown to be right. That it's quite something to be subject to that kind of pressure.
When did you meet Mark Felt?
I didn't meet Mark Felt until he was 90 or in his 80s. Bob Woodward, my colleague, we did all of this work together. He had known Mark Felt, the deputy director of the FBI, from a previous encounter, and Felt, who became known, a source known as Deep Throat, Woodward met with him. I did not. The extraordinary thing about Deep Throat, and there's too much mythology about Deep Throat, is that for the most part what he did was to confirm information we had obtained elsewhere rather than give us original information. But the fact that And there were maybe 8-10 meetings that Bob had with him during the course of Watergate over those 2 years. But the fact that Felt was able to say, you guys are right, stick with this. And on a few occasions, he volunteered some important information. But basically, he confirmed what we were learning elsewhere, so we knew we were right, so that we didn't have a lot of self-doubt, which it would have been very easy to have otherwise.
Most people probably think you had many interactions with Richard Nixon. How many were there?
None. No real interaction. And the only time we saw him during those years, from June 17th, 1972, the time of the break-in, until his resignation, there were two occasions. One was about 10 months in, I went to the White House one day because it had been announced there was going to be that the press secretary was going to have a briefing, because we knew that Nixon's two top aides were probably going to be fired. And so I went there, and instead of the press secretary coming into the room, the President of the United States came into the room. Was I uncomfortable? Yes. Was he uncomfortable? I don't know. I didn't ask any questions. I can't, as I remember, he didn't take any questions. And he made a statement, but it was about a 15-minute occasion. And the other time was there was an awards banquet of one of the Washington Press Association, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that's now become a huge event. And we were to get the top award for our stories. And Nixon was the speaker. But he didn't arrive until after we had gotten our awards. But that's the only other time we saw him during those 2 years, and never met him. He refused to meet with us afterwards. We tried on a number of occasions to see him, but he would never do it.
Why did you choose to keep the identity of Deep Throat secret for so long?
Because it's the most basic of principles that reporters have, that if you assure a source that his identity will not be disclosed, you have to live up to that. And that's how you get information and how you build relationships with sources. They have to treat you, trust you. And we assured Mark Felt we would not disclose his identity. Like almost, you know, if you look, you know, there's a lot of talk about, oh, anonymous sources. It's abused. How can people be using anonymous sources and putting information online or in the paper or on the air? Well, if you look at the 200 or whatever the number of stories we wrote in that period of Watergate, you will not see a single attributed source. They were all anonymous sources. Because obviously these people would have lost their jobs if their helping us had become known. So that's why he was anonymous. And the agreement that we had with our sources was that, and especially when we went to write all the president's men and thereafter, was that we would not disclose their identities in their lifetimes. Our papers are at the University of Texas. And as each person who was a source, some sources said it's okay after Watergate to disclose mm-hmm. their identities, and we did. Felt was not among them. His identity was disclosed by people in his own family, and we confirmed it at that point. And it was secret kept for like 30 years. Most likely because Woodward and I told neither of our ex-wives who it was.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Carl Bernstein.
Yes, Mr. Bernstein. When Mark Felt came out, Pat Buchanan labeled him that he committed treason. What do you think about that?
I think it was hardly treasonous. I think Felt is in the tradition of a great number of people in American history who you can call them whistleblowers, there are different terms for them, who thought that the information that they possessed was more important to be disclosed than kept secret. In this case, it was about a criminal conspiracy led by the President of the United States. I would hardly call that treasonous.
What do you think of the Snowden affair?
It's a very complicated subject. And first of all, I think that there have been statements made by others on Snowden's behalf that have been unnecessarily confrontational. For instance, a journalist named Greenwald, with whom he's been working at one point, said that if the United States continues to go after Mr. Snowden, that he has information that's going to bring the United States to its knees. I think that kind of talk is reckless and irresponsible. At the same time, I think we are learning more and more. I think, one, that Snowden has begun a great and necessary debate in this country about intelligence gathering, and we're learning more and more about the scale of this intelligence gathering by the National Security Agency, and we'll talk more about it in a minute.
You know the drill. Carl Bernstein back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Carl Bernstein with us for another segment, and we will go to more of you as we move along, 297-5633. Carl Bernstein was talking about Edward Snowden when we hit the break. You say he's done a good job of bringing this discussion to the national scene. Where does the discussion go from here?
Well, let me elaborate on that a little bit, because Snowden is very much in the tradition of civil disobedience mm-hmm. by people, certainly in terms of disclosing information that they think people ought to know about. And there usually are two sides to the story of how much should people know. And in this case, It's a very dicey question about how much national security information should be disclosed, and at the same time, it's evident that we do need to know the scale of these operations and that there be safeguards in place to ensure that these huge intelligence gathering, electronic intelligence gathering operations by the National Security Agency and other agencies of government, that they take into consideration the Constitution of the United States, the rights and liberties of all people, as well as foreign leaders and heads of state, which is really the question of the day right now, and we can talk about that in a minute. But look, the threat of terrorism, we live in a different age, and the threat of terrorism is real. And we have the means, partly through electronic surveillance of phone and email correspondence, to almost as a vacuum cleaner, suck up these billions of bits of information and extract from them electronically and digitally certain key phrases, key words, key people. Well, that's great. The bad news is that it can be abused. And so the question is, and what Snowden has done, it seems to me, that's quite beneficial, is to let us know the scale on which this is being done, and that we now can have a debate and learn whether it has been abused. Because there is no question that with this capability, a Nixon, for example, the capacity for a leader who is not concerned about constitutional safeguards, the abuse could be huge. And what we're seeing partly is that the court mechanism that's set up to make sure that supposedly that this ability will not be abused, well, it's not working so well. There have been some abuses, but by and large, I don't think we've seen large-scale abuse so far as we know yet. But now we're going to have a real debate about how do we try to balance the interests of civil liberties and this necessary intelligence gathering to protect us from what's real, terrorist threat.
Ed on Highland. Ed, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bernstein.
Good morning.
I've listened closely to your colorful revival of this dark night in our history. I think it's, Jim, especially appropriate that he has invited you at this time, very timely. We see a striking similarity with the current administration's, especially its deception of the public, the constitutional abuse that you referred to earlier, and its vindictiveness towards its towards the political enemies.
Can you tell me what you're speaking of specifically there?
Yes, the spying on the for the NSA, the IRS abuses of individual privacy, and of course, most of all, I guess the current Obamacare fiasco.
Well, let me try to divide those up because I don't see many similarities. I think we're talking apples and oranges here. Let's first talk about the first example that you gave was using the NSA against political enemies? Let me make sure I don't misquote you.
Well,
what was your first example?
I think
example?
That's what he did imply, that and the IRS.
But did you seem to say that the Obama...
He's gone, but...
Well, first of all, there is no evidence whatsoever that I know of that these NSA operations have been used against political opponents of the President of the United States. No evidence at all. And I would be hugely surprised if any information developed to that extent. This question, though, of whether or not the communications of foreign leaders like Merkel of Germany and the French president, whether their communications were monitored or intercepted, that would be a disgraceful business. And if it happened, who did the information go to? and for what purposes, and we need to know. But I don't think we know yet the answers to those questions, and we certainly have no evidence of Obama or anybody else in the White House using any of this information against political enemies. Then the example the caller gave was the so-called IRS investigations that of largely Republican and really Tea Party organizations. And it turns out that the charge of it being politically motivated, and certainly at the level of the White House, turns out not to be true. That what these investigations were about, and there's no question, incidentally, that some people in the IRS, particularly in the Cincinnati office, ought to have their ass kicked and maybe be fired for what occurred. But the notion that somehow information that people were persecuted by the White House for their political beliefs turns out to be simply not true. That what was happening is that these organizations had applied for tax-exempt status as Democratic and Republican nonprofit organizations must, and that almost all of the applications for that nonprofit status during that period and in that particular office were Tea Party, or many of them were Tea Party related, and clearly something happened there that shouldn't have happened in that office, but there's been no evidence whatsoever to suggest that any information went to the White House, that the White House knew about it, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think there's any comparison.
Mike on Blue Bonnet, please be brief. You're on with Carl Bernstein.
Well, I wasn't very brief.
No.
First of all, Mr. Bernstein, I read your book, saw the movie. You all did an incredible job.
Thank you.
One of the questions I had goes beyond it. The Pentagon Papers, I never really understood whether that was a breach of security or not. Could you just answer that?
Let's for those who don't know ancient history like you and me, let's say what the Pentagon Papers were. It was a secret study undertaken during the Johnson administration of the preparation and pursuit and conduct of the war in Vietnam. And it was ordered by the Secretary of Defense because it was clear to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara that the war was not winnable at a certain point, that it was not going well, and he wanted for future purposes to try and determine what had gone wrong. And he ordered this massive study in the Pentagon of how we got there. And in the process, Daniel Ellsberg, an employee of the Defense Department who had been in Vietnam, thought, and again, it's a little bit like Snowden in this case, thought that this information needed to be disclosed. And in this tradition of civil disobedience, he gave these papers to the New York Times, which proceeded to publish them and write stories about it. And after two or three days, the Nixon White House sought to have a court order to prohibit further publication and to get a permanent injunction against the paper's publication. Other newspapers, the Washington Post included, went on to continue publishing them. And eventually the Supreme Court upheld the rights of the newspapers to publish these papers, found that national security had not been violated, and that indeed is the case. You know, nine times out of ten or more, my experience is that claims that the press is endangering national security by publishing or disclosing this, that, or the other thing turn out to be red herrings. In the case of the Pentagon Papers, it was certainly the case. North Vietnamese learned nothing from the Pentagon Papers. They didn't know from the ground, no damage to the national security resulted.
A few questions I'll forward. What's the national perception of Louisiana politics?
I'm not very good at knowing what the national perception is about anything. I think that, look, Louisiana, I can just talk about my own knowledge or lack of knowledge
of
Louisiana politics. You got an amazing history here. You got to go back to Huey Long and before, and there's a kind of some continuity in the nature of Louisiana politics. This is a southern state that's had some of the same earth-shattering racial events that other southern states have had, and it figures in the history of the Democratic Party of Louisiana and the Republican Party of Louisiana. Got a lot of colorful figures involved. There's obviously been a lot of swamp gas involving corruption. Whether that's worse than other states, I don't know. I live in New York, and I would put Albany right up there with Baton Rouge. I would think that no state legislature could be more dysfunctional than the one that we have in New York, but maybe you all come close. I don't know enough about what goes on down here. But you know, the real thing that's going on in the politics of our country is this ideological polarization. The state legislatures, Democrat and Republican control, have irresponsibly gerrymandered the congressional districts to the point where the Congress of the United States, you get elected to Congress, you're there for life, except for maybe 50 seats out of 435. It's despicable. It's disgraceful. And the only way you get voted out is not by the opposition party. It's when your own party runs somebody against you from the left or the right to railroad you out because they don't think you're pure enough. And hence the Tea Party is trying to move some Republicans off, and the left of the Democratic Party is trying to move, or sometimes the center, trying to move some on the left off. But basically, you got a sinecure for life if you're a member of Congress. This is not the citizen legislature that the founders envisioned. And it's broken. And the state legislatures, by and large in this country, have the same polarization ideologically that we're seeing in the Congress. What we do have, thank God, are a lot of governors in this country of both parties who understand the problems of their people and their states from the ground up. And they're not quite so, you know, they have philosophical principles, and they have ideology. But they put the common good above ideological interest. And that is what is not happening in Washington. It's not happening in the state legislatures for the most part. What's happening, let me be more specific about Washington. It's not happening in the House of Representatives, hardly at all, is the national interest of real concern to so many members of the House of Representatives, the Senate a little more so. But the Senate's not a terribly functional institution either. The Congress of the United States is broken. The constitutional system is broken. When one of three branches of the government doesn't work, our constitutional system is broken, and that's where we are. And some of it, and a lot of it, you cannot say, oh, it's just those people in Washington. They got sent here by somebody. People are getting what they want to some extent. They might say, oh, they're awful. They got 10% approval rating. Well, they vote for these people. And they, too many people have these same closed minds, ideologically driven, not open to the best obtainable version of the truth, not open to contextual fact. The history in this country of philosophical political debate has usually been that we might disagree violently, going back to the framers and back to the Federalists. We might disagree about how to get from A to B, but rarely have we disagreed about what the basic facts are. There goes my cell phone.
Well,
which I
when we've got a minute left,
you want to hear my cell phone, everybody? There it is. There, I turned it off.
You're okay. Is Hillary the next president?
Nobody knows who the next president is. Will Hillary seek the presidency? She's in the process of deciding whether to seek it, meaning how well the waters will envelop her and carry her. If she is healthy, if Bill Clinton is healthy, I think we can expect that she is going to run, providing that the soundings that are taken by Hillary Clinton, by Bill Clinton, and those around them hold, that she has a pretty good chance of winning. And right now there's a chance, it seems to me, she certainly has to be considered a favorite for the nomination of the Democratic Party, and certainly competitive as a presidential candidate.
Well, that was Carl Bernstein's last book, A Woman in Charge. His next one will be The Washington Star. And we thank him for spending an hour with us.
Good
thank you, Carl.
Here. Thank you.
And thank you for listening, everybody. Until tomorrow, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.